This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. The selling of Tuesday's $535 billion federal budget is well underway. The day after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau delivered a campaign-style speech, while the opposition conservatives have been trashing the minority Liberal government's latest economic blueprint. It was designed to appeal to younger generations, millennials and Gen Zs, to give them what the Liberals are calling generational fairness. Joining Libby for a discussion, Muhammad Ali, Liberal strategist and senior consultant at Crestview Strategy in Ottawa, John Mikitishyn, conservative activist, political consultant, and president of Bradgate Research Group, and Taylor Skolan, co-founder of The Peak.
Much of what was in there that I think is relevant to young people has been announced over the past couple weeks. I think it's good to see the movement finally on housing, especially, and ramping up the supply of new housing. I think there was some good stuff in there that's promising. Changing some of the tax rules around rental apartments, I think, will be good. The question I would have is any of this actually going to bear fruit for the government in their current term in office? And I guess, I would leave that to the political strategist. But on a substance level, I think there were some promising things.
John Mikitishyn, what did you think?
Interesting, desperate final or second final budget by a government that is committed to people in the banking industry, giving them more money than ever before, and really doesn't serve anybody. And I don't think this, at the end of the day, is going to appeal to anybody, because most people know that when the bulk of this budget is supposed to actually take effect, the Liberals will already be out of office.
I guess the point of the budget was to try to prevent that from happening, Mohammed.
This budget was designed entirely for, or mostly entirely for, the millennial and Gen Z population. I mean, the millennials were the ones who helped catapult Justin Trudeau to a majority government in 2015. And many of those people who were there early to mid 20s are now in their, 30s now, who are trying to start a family, trying to, get to the next level of their careers, buy a house. And so very much targeted towards bringing them back into the Liberal tent to reactivate that energy that they have with them, as they're now the largest voting bloc as well from a millennial's perspective. I think this budget, well, yes, there are some things that are going to take years to build. If we just thought about what's going to be built tomorrow, I don't think nothing would ever get done. But there are some measures that really are going to gear to help de-risk investments for home construction, right? They're taking up the GST rebates for student housing being developed on campuses and such. There are all these other components. It's a pretty comprehensive housing plan. And I think it needs to be given a little bit of credit that this is pretty robust. We could have made the argument it should have been done 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, to be prepared. But look, we're in a crisis now, and this government is responding. And I think they made it very clear with the pretty comprehensive housing plan.
Taylor, from your point of view, the point of view of your circle of friends and colleagues, do you think this will accomplish what the Liberals want, which is to make people in your demographic vote for them?
Until rents start coming down, until home prices start being more affordable for people, I really don't see them tuning into what the Prime Minister is saying. And, I'm not going to comment on whether that's fair or not, but I think that's the reality. This has come very late in this government, and for a lot of people, I think they've stopped listening.
Pierre Poilievre, the conservative leader, started talking about housing and affordability a long time ago. Is that why you think the younger demos are attracted to him?
I'm not sure if it's an attraction to him personally, or if it's an aversion to the status quo, and he is the main alternative at hand right now. I'm not sure, but you know, I think the housing issue certainly resonates with people, and I think he's been well served by talking about it amongst younger voters, certainly.
John McEtishan, I mean, there's a lot of speculation about what Jagmeet Singh is going to do. He was not very happy with the budget, but I'm pretty sure he's going to vote for it.
He's in a very tough place. He's painted himself into a corner. He has to support the government. He has to support the budget. It's almost as if you know, his greatest wish came true, and, you know, he's a virtual partner with the prime minister, but he gets none of the credit for the good things, and he takes all the heat for the bad things. So, you know, his unhappiness is not going to end until after the next election.
John McEtishan, conservative activist, political consultant, and president of Bradgate Research Group. Taylor Skolan, co-founder of The Peak, and Muhammad Ali, liberal strategist and senior consultant at Crestview Strategy in Ottawa. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. At Toronto City Hall, Mayor Olivia Chow reacted to what was in and not in the federal Liberal budget delivered on Tuesday. We know the mayor is happy about the budget's emphasis on creating affordable housing, 3.9 million new homes by 2031. Olivia Chow told reporters, "We can start building housing and some percentage of it will be affordable." Joining me when I was filling in for Libby on Thursday to discuss, David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto, among many other accomplishments, Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, and Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak.
They've taken a number of measures that will alleviate some of the housing crunch here. More funding. I think it's not exactly clear how much of the several billion dollars is going to be going to Toronto specifically out of like the bigger housing fund, which is 15 something billion. They've also freed up some land, the federal land that can have housing built on it. So I think that's a really positive step. I would just, this is almost personal because I happened to tune into a Committee of Adjustments hearing at City Hall yesterday. And ultimately, though, it comes down to the city if they really want to solve this housing crisis, because you hear this refrain over and over again where you have these projects that want to add density to the city, and these people on the Committee of Adjustments say this is a great project. It's fantastic that we're adding density. It's the right project, but not the right place. So I think that the city needs to step up and make some changes to their own zoning rules and allow density as a right, which will allow federal money to go into projects quicker and get things built faster and add density throughout the city.
Karen, coming at it from a former city councillor's point of view, and now you are going to be running for the Conservatives federally. How does this all work? I mean, it sounds like tons and tons of housing, but how does it work from Toronto's perspective?
The building time from, you know, from concept to when you put the key in the lock of a new home is a long time. And, you know, we've got some in Toronto, we've got some of the longest approval times in North America. And so part of what we need to do is figure out how to get approvals done and projects under construction and people moved in at a much more rapid pace than we currently see. And, you know, some of the projects around, you know, forcing density in neighborhoods, you can do that. Some of those projects are economically viable, some are not. And so I think that we end up not having the right discussions if we focus on how some neighborhoods are responding to density. The conversation we need to have is how do we get these projects approved quicker, and particularly when there's federal money involved and along transit lines. And that's what Pierre Poilievre has been talking about, is that it doesn't make any sense that our housing prices are as expensive as they are, except for the fact that we don't have enough. And making sure we have more means we have to shorten that approval cycle and actually get shovels in the ground.
David, your initial thoughts on the federal money for housing in Toronto?
Whatever needs to be done for market housing, and I heard Karen speak to that, if you're going to have affordable housing in the city, it requires more than simply understanding the supply will do it. It needs to have really well done government participation with the private sector and community groups to build housing. It's not simply a simple question of supply. And the more we keep repeating that and don't insist that we find ways in which to work governments and community groups and the private sector who are builders together, we're not going to have affordable housing.
What do you think in terms of what was offered in actually making it happen in relation to what you're talking about there?
No, I think that the federal government, for those who are interested in building affordable housing, that I think it's lining up the things that are required in order to do it. What it needs to do and what needs to be done is whether it's take the leadership from the city, which I prefer, or from the federal government or the provincial government, some government has to take the lead and say, here's projects. Here's a set of projects that comes from land ownership that either has been public or we've gathered it together in terms of land banking. We have to find ways to work on actual public projects and not simply assume that if you make an announcement, it is done.
David Crombie, former mayor of Toronto, Karen Stintz, CEO at Variety Village, and Alex Blumenstein, co-founder of The Peak. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, are cancer screening guidelines as current as they could be? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The latest cancer screening controversy started the conversation with our medical record panel on Wednesday. A federally appointed body called the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Health issues guidelines around screening. Now, another group of medical experts is calling some of those guidelines dangerous and outdated. For instance, they recommend mammograms starting at age 50, while in some provinces, women are encouraged to start at 40. Dr. Elisa Naiman is a family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Fahad Razak is Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre.
Every Western country has something like the Canadian Task Force, which is a group of people who are charged with developing recommendations around population-based screening programs. And we have the Canadian Task Force. This is a highly credible group. On the other hand, if you look at this coalition of healthcare screening group and go to their website, it's very unclear who they are, how they're funded. They haven't done any specific work or evidence reviews of screening, and it's much more of an advocacy group. And the challenge with that, honestly, is that if you make a change in a recommendation about screening, there can be people who can benefit economically for that. If we expand screening for breast cancer to 40, that means more tests, more radiologists get to read those tests, more clinics get to make money, the companies who make the screening machines make money. So you have to be very careful about conflict of interest. So I'm not saying that this coalition is conflicted, but it's very unclear what their funding is and what their agenda is.
Fahad?
The article starts with really honestly inflammatory language that is attacking colleagues, but also in many ways, I think, scaring the public using words, as he said, like dangerous and deplorable about, you know, a volunteer body that's trying to interpret evidence and provide best care for Canada. The point of a conflict of interest is really important. You know, it's interesting. If you Google my name, one of the first things that comes up is my conflict of interest statement, because if you sit in these bodies where you're making recommendations that will affect millions of people in the country and you are potentially going to cost the taxpayers hundreds of thousands, millions and millions of dollars. It does matter how you make your own money, who pays you. These things are very important. And you see for one body, clear conflict of interest declarations. You can look on every single person if they've had income from any of these funding bodies, if they've ever made money off of things that are related to the guidance they're giving. For the other group, no conflict of interest provided. And so it is, to me, when I look at this, I see one body which again, I'm not an expert on whether it should be 40 or 50. It looks like breast cancer screening is going to shift towards their 40s, at least in the United States, maybe in Canada. But to me, the bigger question here is, how do we put these guidelines together?
Alisa, one of the things I read from this group was that it confuses doctors about when to screen. But if doctors know that someone is at high risk, they can screen them. I mean, I started getting screening long before the age of 50. And at the end, I found the breast cancer with a lump in between screens.
As part of my job, on a yearly basis, I review with my patients whether or not there's any changes to their family history. That would then change what their risk would be. And if somebody has multiple people in their family or somebody who gets diagnosed at a certain age, then that changes the conversation compared to somebody who's an average risk patient. But what I start to do, and I'll be honest, that in terms of whether or not somebody wants to be screened, and one of the big things that I'm counseling women on is that the very first time you go, there is a very high chance that you're going to get recalled. You're going to be waiting a couple weeks to go back for your appointment. You're going to think you have cancer, and you need to be aware that this is going to be a stressful time. And oftentimes, they find things. The imaging is so good that lots of things are picked up, and it forces people to go back for further imaging at the time. They might be going for imaging in 6 months. They might be going imaging in a year. And I think people have to understand the pros and cons of going for when you would start to screen for a mammogram. And often people will say, I'm okay, I'm going to wait. And I'm like, okay, we'll have this conversation again in a year and we'll make a decision then. And some people are like, this really stresses me out and I really want to go. I understand. Please send the referral.
Dr. Alisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. A call by all of Ontario's party leaders, including PC Premier Doug Ford, to reduce a ban on wearing a keffiyeh in the legislature failed to pass a unanimous vote on Thursday. The Speaker, Ted Arnott, who originally imposed the ban, acknowledged the request to have the ban reversed, and when it was put to a unanimous vote, he said he could hear some no's. So for now, the ban stands. Keffiyehs are black and white checked scarves, culturally worn by Arabs, but have been used to serve as a symbol of the Palestinian resistance movement. Ted Arnott decided to impose the ban, saying he sees it as being intended to be a political statement since October 7th. When the Hamas terror attacks triggered the Israel-Hamas war. But Premier Ford and the other party leaders put out statements saying they would like the decision reversed, the premier saying it needlessly divides the people of our province. On Thursday, we discussed the issue, and I began the conversation with Ontario Green Party leader Mike Schreiner about the vote to reverse the ban, which did not pass with unanimous approval, asking him first what happened.
The motion was a unanimous consent motion. So that then leads to a voice kind of vote of yay or nay. And if everyone says yes, it passes. And even if one person says no, it doesn't. And there was an individual who did say no. And so the motion doesn't pass because it's not unanimous consent. It doesn't mean that a similar motion could be brought forward at some time in the future. I was surprised and disappointed because all four party leaders have said that they would like to see the speaker reverse the ban of wearing keffiyehs in the legislature. But as the speaker noted, it will take, he will abide by a unanimous consent motion. And unfortunately, that did not happen this morning.
So the ban stands. It kind of came out of the blue, the whole thing. Why do you think the Speaker, Ted Arnott, enacted the ban of the keffiyeh in the first place?
Well, I think I don't want to speculate or speak on behalf of the Speaker, so that I'm not sure about. When I learned of this on Tuesday, I wrote a letter on Wednesday morning, first thing, asking the speaker to reconsider, because for many people, the keffiyeh is you know, part of their cultural attire. And so while some people may see it as a political statement, for many people, it's part of their cultural clothing. And we certainly don't ban other forms of cultural clothing at Queen's Park. And I certainly would not want us to do that. And so I felt that the speaker should reconsider the ban. And the speaker made it clear this morning that if there was unanimous consent, he obviously would fulfill the wishes of the House and reverse the ban. But unfortunately, one person said no to the UC motion.
Now we go to Richard Robertson of B'nai B'rith Canada, the country's oldest independent Jewish human rights organization. So how do you see this issue of banning wearing the keffiyeh in the legislature?
We believe that the speaker's decision is in line with the policy of the legislature. The keffiyeh was once an innocuous cultural symbol. However, the keffiyeh's meaning has been politicized since October 7th. The politicization has only increased. Therefore, the speaker took action, which is in line with the policies of the legislature that prohibit political clothing or items of demonstration in the gallery and that prevent members of provincial parliament from wearing props.
How did this come to be? Did B'nai B'rith Canada as an organization call for the banning of the keffiyeh? Were you involved in advocating for that in any way?
No, we were not. However, we are supportive of the measure. We have been concerned by the misappropriation of the meaning of the keffiyeh by members of provincial parliament, by visitors to Queen's Park, and as well by members of the federal parliament.
So what political symbolism do you feel it now represents, the keffiyeh, since the terror attacks on Israel October 7th?
Well, as you indicated earlier in the segment, Jane, the keffiyeh has been affiliated with Palestinian resistance movements, some of which are terror groups. Since the 1960s, it was popularized by Yasser Arafat and has been worn as a symbol by members of other terror factions. So we do believe that it is an inciting and a divisive political prop. It no longer has the same cultural meaning that it used to when being worn in the legislature.
Richard Robertson of B'nai B'rith Canada, and before him, Ontario Green Party leader Mike Schreiner. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Sita in Mississauga phoned about the federal budget money for housing when Variety Village CEO and former city councillor Karen Stintz was among our panelists.
So everyone was screaming for more housing and blaming the federal government for not doing anything, And now the government is giving billions of dollars. Why are mayors not jumping at this money and build 2 to 3 story buildings with underground parking, do more rentals, which is more affordable for people, and more shelters?
Governments are balancing a lot of interests as well, and it's again a function of what projects are already being planned and what can be executed more quickly versus how do we protect affordable units, because those are two different issues. And then building the three stories across all the avenues is been something the city has been advocating for as long as I've been on council. It's just the government is not in a position right now to be building that housing, so we're reliant on the private sector to do it. And to date, it hasn't been economical for that to happen. And so trying to figure out how to encourage the private sector to build the homes that we need is one thing. And then, supporting that through loans and low-interest loans is another. But then if the government is actually in the business of building houses, which I don't suggest they do, then that's another thing entirely.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Wanda in Mississauga, who phoned about the ongoing crisis in long-term care.
I'm outraged that the fact that everybody pays to go to these long care homes, yet they don't get the care they need.
Yeah.
There's something wrong. I'm going to be 62 this year. It's a very scary situation. I hope I never have to go to one.
I hear you.
Kept my mom at home till she died. Thankfully, she only went there for 2 weeks and passed at the hospital. So God help anybody that's got to go in a nursing home.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at FightbackLibby and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Zeev Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.